WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. By the time Yugoslavian journalist Slavenka Drakulic was finishing her book, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, she wasn't laughing. She was preparing for civil war. Yugoslavia's first free elections since World War II were held in May of 1990. Non-communist governments were elected in Croatia and Slovenia. The republics later declared their independence and the country split apart. Drakulic is visiting the States, and she's my guest today. Our book critic John Leonard gave a very enthusiastic review of her new book earlier this week. The book is a collection of essays about women's lives in Eastern Europe under communism. Drakulic was a founding member of the first network of Eastern European women's groups. She's a columnist for a magazine published in Zagreb, and she's written for Ms. Magazine and The Nation. So how does she think of herself now? As a Yugoslavian? A Croatian?
No, there is no Yugoslavia anymore, and I'm Croatian. I am not only that I am Croatian citizen, but I'm also Croatian. So, it is a strange feeling. I mean, when you are 42 and all of a sudden the country where you were born actually disappears or falls apart, it is one of the feelings that people don't like to talk much about. And I guess it's the same thing over in ex-Soviet Union. You know, we were used, at least my generation, I was born in 1949, and I was used to live in the country that was called Yugoslavia. And it is a kind of a big psychological change apart from war that you have to say, well, I don't live in Yugoslavia anymore. I live in Croatia, you know. There are bad and good things about that, you know. There are, you know, if the nation wants and votes for independence, this is okay for me. On the other hand, I don't want the leaders that are now in power to tell me, listen, your 42 years in communism were not good. This is all bad. These were all lies. Because I think that I have right to my life, and I think that I have rights to my memories, and I don't want to erase nothing from my past. The thing is that there is a lot of that process of erasing the past going on in Europe, all throughout Eastern Europe.
Oh, so you think there's a lot of revisionism and people are supposed
Absolutely.
To forget about the past?
Yeah, well, this is. They change the names of the streets, which is pretty much normal, you know. But there is this tendency of the new governments, of the new democratic governments, to erase 40 years of communism, you know. Maybe it is even natural, you know, but I don't think it is good. I don't think it is good to remove all the names of the streets, to remove all the monuments, for example. And there is really, I think, not only revisionism, but very much of the revenge going on. Too.
Has your national identity changed, your sense of yourself?
Oh, it has changed a lot. I mean, first of all, my generation was brought up differently. The nationality wasn't important for us all that much, you know. And especially in Yugoslavia, because we were connected with the world. We could travel, we had passports, as you know, opposed to the Eastern European bloc, which countries, people from the bloc countries couldn't get out, you know. So we were more, I think, you know, connected with the world. And actually we saw ourselves, that at least my generation, in terms of, you know, belonging to the world, at least mentally, you know. So it wasn't really a big deal for me to be a Croat, or I went to school with many Serbs or Muslims, but I never could make, actually, and I was never interested in making a difference. You know, it was more of the cultural thing, you know, because, for example, Croats are Catholics and Serbs are Orthodox, you know. So there was a difference to the extent, but it wasn't, in my view, it wasn't very important difference.
Has the Civil War made sense to you?
Well, you know, you have to make sense of it. This is because this is where you live and this is where your life is, and you have to make sense of it. And I have to say it takes very long to make sense out of civil war. You have to understand all the historical conditions. You have to understand present conditions. You have to understand that the communism is going away. And then when the communism is going away, I mean, is breaking down, is disappearing, what is there? There is nothing but nationalism and religion there, you know, because the communism was such a system that was actually, you had the feudal societies, and then you had communist ideology, like as if glued to it, you know, and then there was nothing of the institutions of a civil society that were built within communist society. So, for example, you didn't have any, you know, ideas about the civil rights, for example, or about, you know, freedom of expression, or all these kind of things that exist in the West. So basically, when communism started to fall apart, what happened is that Peter people identify, I mean, they stick to religion and to nationality, two things that they only know. And paradoxically, I think it's a paradox that nationalism and religion became actually the symbols of freedom in throughout Eastern Europe.
You live in Zagreb.
Yes, it's Croatia. It's the capital of Croatia.
Has there been much fighting where you live?
No. Croatia, Zagreb is a capital, you know, and it's more to the west and to the north. So the main fights have been to the east, you know, and to the south. So one third of the country has been occupied and bombed, and it's in terrible condition. But Zagreb has been only threatened by air raid alarms. In one day, for example, we had 18 air raid alarms. TV transmitter, do you call it TV transmitter?
Yeah.
Was bombed, and the presidential residence was also bombed. But other than that, no, city wasn't harmed. There were other cities that were terribly bombed. For example, Osijek, it is still shelled, you know. They're still shelling Osijek in spite of UN troops coming there. Vukovar, that was, it is a Baroque, wonderful Baroque city, 50,000 people. It was erased from the earth. This city doesn't exist anymore. Then Dubrovnik, I think about 30% of historical monuments have been damaged in Dubrovnik. So there has been a lot of harm done. And it's about, I think now, a little bit less, or about 300 churches that have been demolished by shelling or by gunfighting or whatever, you know. So the war has done, you know, us an enormous damage. And always, you know, on the very intimate level, I think everyone asks herself or himself, was it worth it, you know?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't have answer to that, you know. In order to find the answer, as many, I think, people in my place and in many countries are doing the same thing. I'm a novelist. I'm a writer. I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book, honestly, to find that answer, you know, because this is not the answer that we are going to find very easily. This is the question that we are going to ask ourselves as a nation and as a citizens of Croatia, and I think also on the very personal level in the next couple of years, in the next 10, maybe 20 years, because the war is actually not over, you know. The troops, UN troops will come, and we don't know what will happen with the borders. We don't know how long troops are going to stay there. Actually, we don't know very much about our future. So these kind of questions, very serious questions on who we are and what was the price and was this price worth it, this has to be answered, you know, on the long term, you know. When you talk to the people from Vukovar, for example, who barely survived it, or the fighters there, well, they think it wasn't worth it, you know. So for some other people who really badly wanted independence, as for example, the top politicians, perhaps it was worth for them, you know. But I think it is one of the questions that we have to answer very, very seriously and slowly, because those are very serious questions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Slavinka Draculic, who is a Croatian journalist who's just completed a new book of essays called How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. In your book, you write about how you felt cheated by the way communism ended in Yugoslavia. It wasn't the kind of happy, laughing, smiling end of communism that you found in Poland and Czechoslovakia. What was different right away?
Well, it's very hard to say what was different. You know, I really envied those people in East Germany and in Poland and Czechoslovakia, especially in Czechoslovakia. I think everyone was envying people in Czechoslovakia because they didn't spill blood. It was really very very peaceful, and Václav Havel became president. You know, who wouldn't like Václav Havel for president? I surely would. And then, but you know, in Yugoslavia, things were going differently. First of all, we had elections in different republics in different time, you know. And then also it was already when we had elections in April and May of 1991, it was already it was tense, you know. The situation was already tense. There was a tension in the air. And somehow, I think there was a fear in the air already. And it didn't bring all this, you know, people in the street smiling, being cheerful because something is changing, is happening. We had also people in the street, but it was different. It was always connected with a problem of nationalism, you know. So it was, I think it was, the tension was already in the air, and it makes all difference in the world looking at the Eastern Europe, you're comparing to the other Eastern European countries.
You say you were even let down by the end of communism in terms of what it would bring you. You always thought that peaches would be sweeter and larger when communism was over, and they were the same.
Well, you know, this is one of those pictures. It is a kind of a metaphor for the better life that everyone expected. You know, in 1989, I think everyone was so very happy and dancing when the Berlin Wall came down. One of the reasons was, I think, consumerism, among the other things. It means that, you know, you instantly think you are going to get it. Color TV, you're going to get car, you're going to get a good refrigerator, you're going to get VCR, everything instantly, much more money, much more everything, you know. But apparently during 2 years, nothing much changed. I think many things changed for the worse because people didn't feel so secure. The safety network that was created during the communist regime, even if it was actually based on the equal distribution of poverty, it existed. People felt safe, you know, with their jobs and housing and the prices of food. And when that didn't exist anymore, people, you know, and they didn't get actually all that they expected, all the beautiful life, you know, that you see on American TV, especially on American TV. And then people were actually disappointed. So this is, I think we should take it as a metaphor, you know. And it is kind of sad that because for during communism, people were, you know, they were used to expect better life. They were telling us, well, you know, the better future, the brighter future, as we called it, is going to come. And, well, it seems it's not coming. I mean, you have to work for that brighter future, and it is disappointing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Slavinka Draculic, and she's a Croatian journalist who has a new book of essays called How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Croatian journalist Slavinka Draculic is my guest. You say that you think women carried the biggest burdens of everyday life under communism in Eastern Europe. Give me some examples of that.
Well, you know, here you say that, for example, women have a double shift, that they work, at their working places, and they come home and they work at home, take care of the home completely, right, of children, of everything, cooking and so on. I think for women in Eastern Europe, it was triple, you know. They had a triple burden because they not only have to take care in a very patriarchal society, you know, you have to know that throughout Eastern Europe, the society is really very patriarchal. It means that men are not helping women at all. It means that we have the emancipation on a public level, you know, but not in a private sphere. So it is not that you have to take care only of your family, but you have to provide for your family. It means that you have to find the food for your family. There are no facilities. There are no machines that would help you. There is no food enough. So you actually spend much more time, and you have to work much harder than women throughout Western Europe, you know. And men, they come home and they read, sleep. I mean, you know how men are.
I remember a while ago I interviewed Francine Duplessis Gray after her book about mm-hmm. Soviet women, and we got to talking about the lack of Tampax and sanitary napkins for women there. And I got a letter from a male listener who said, how can you talk about such trivial things on the radio?
Well, this is the problem.
I'd like you to explain why the question of tampons and sanitary napkins is not a trivial question.
Well, I think it's a basic question. It is a basic question on several levels. Number one, it is a basic question because it says very much about planned economy. It says how economy in communism works. Tampax as well as the toilet paper you can use as the example that the planned economy in communism actually doesn't work. And it doesn't work because it doesn't, not only, you know, you have these 5 years plans, you know, and these 5 years plans always take in account important things like, I don't know, production of the steel, but they never come to the everyday trivia. And I think on that level, of the level of the everyday trivia, this is where exactly communism failed. It failed on the Tampax. It failed because Tampax and the toilet paper and the food are bare necessities. So you can produce steel, but if you cannot produce bare necessities for the people, people are not going to go with this system. They are not going to trust that system. And I think this is basically the question, or the answer to that question is trust. People didn't trust that. Women couldn't trust that because they didn't have really not only Tampaxes, but they didn't have even smaller things like, I don't know, you know, if you don't have a choice, and this is one of the very important things to have in your life, at least a small choice.
So now that communism has fallen, can you get tampons in where you live?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, if you go to Romania or to Bulgaria, you're not likely to find either tampons or toilet paper. The problem is, however, that it is those societies are in transition. It means that the market economy didn't come yet there, you know, with good and bad things, because I have my opinion on that too. But I think that eventually, you know, wherever there is a possibility of private initiative, there will be a way, you know, to give these necessities to people. So probably they will have to pay very, very high price for that in terms of money, you know, because it's not going to be cheap. It's still going to be some kind of luxury, some kind of privilege in a very poor society, in a very poor economy. But at least you will have that, you know. But it really proves that you cannot build a system from above. You cannot build a system that doesn't take into account what people really need, from food to Tampax to human rights issue.
What's the status of abortion now in the republics that used to be Yugoslavia?
Well, the status is good, you know. As far as nothing changed. But what I'm very much afraid of is, as I mentioned before, is the influence of the Catholic Church. The thing is that in Croatia, what happened is that one manager of one hospital, he banned the abortion in his hospital, which is entirely against the law, you know. He did it in November. And all of a sudden, that I thought that, you know, this would not happen. But what happened is that there was a lot of letters to the editors, there was a lot of articles, there was a lot of pressure, you know, public pressure, and it became an issue in Croatia. So he was forced to withdraw, of course, you know, because this was not really according to law. But it shows both the tendency to restrict the right and also the tendency of women and of people not to give up.
Now, you were the co-founder of one of Yugoslavia's first feminist groups, or maybe I should say of Yugoslavia's first feminist group. This was organized in 1978.
Yes.
What were the first issues that you and the other women in this group were really desperate to talk to each other about?
Well, first of all, we were desperate to make people realize that there is such an issue, you know, because what the answers that we got from the government, from the official organization of women that always existed, you know, connected with the Communist Party, there was always one organization, state organization. They were asking, what do you want? I mean, why do you want even to bring these issues of women being unequal to men or whatever when you have law that equals men and women, you have equal rights. What actually do you really want? Now, what we wanted is to present people with the problems that were never named in our country. For example, problem of rape, of problem of domestic violence, of problem of not being, in other words, not being emancipated in a private sphere. Or, you know, in a patriarchal society like in Yugoslavia, it is very common that men beat their wives when they come home, especially in the villages, you know. And for these women to realize that that it doesn't have to be so, it is a major thing. It's a major issue, you know. And there are many. For example, child molesting. This is a question that has never, even until now, has never been addressed in that country. So there are many, many, many issues of that kind that we were, keen to talk about. And this is why we gathered. But it was very difficult. It was a desperate struggle because everyone was against us, principally because. It was as if the feminism is influence of the bourgeois ideology from the West, and this shouldn't be we shouldn't be influenced, you know, by this kind of bad ideology. So it was feminism was given bad word right from the very, very, very beginning.
Well, what kind of contact did you have with feminist groups in the West, and how do you think your brand of feminism in Yugoslavia compared to what American feminists wanted and needed?
Well, it's an entirely different thing. You know, I think that the international families went through different phases. At one point, we thought that we all have the same problems. But then we realized that the problems varies to, they are different according to the region where people live. And I think that eventually American families who tended at the beginning to be the leaders of the world feminist movement eventually realized that this is not, that could, it couldn't be done, you know. You cannot lead the feminist world movement from the United States of America. You might have facilities, you might have money, you might have books on that, you might have this and that, but you don't realize how, what is the regional, what are the regional problems. But I've seen the tendency right now after 1989 for many women scholars to go there and to look at the lives of women there, and there is an essay in the book about that, about theory, I mean feminist theory and the real life in Eastern Europe, and seeing the life in Eastern Europe through their glasses or through their eyes, you know. In other words, not seeing it realistically, you know. First of all, there is no movement there. And on the other hand, women there are afraid to organize. You know, it wasn't possible to organize on the grassroots level. So if you come to women and say, let's organize a feminist group, oh, women will get afraid of that. So you have to work on the different issues. I think the way to work there, the way feminism works there, worked there and is going to work is to concentrate on a specific issues, you know, and not even to mention very much the word feminism, just to concentrate on the problems that women have and start to work on the grassroots level. And this is the only way it could work. And I think this is the only right way. But the issues are different, you know. Before we had abortion, women in the West didn't have abortion, you know, so we had maternal leave, paid maternal leave, 1 year maternal leave, 2 years maternal leave. This is what women in this country never had. So the issues are different, and I think the approaches should be different. And I think women slowly start to realize that on the both sides.
How did you learn to speak English so fast?
You
talk faster than I do.
Yeah, the thing is that I really speak fast. They always tell me to slow down. I'm sorry. I mean, I make terrible mistakes, but I always tend to, you know, I don't know. I didn't learn it to speak fast. I just learned it. And because I speak fast, any language. And I speak fast Italian, too.
Slavenka Draculic is the author of the new book, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. I'll spell her last name for you. That's Draculic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.